Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we are discussing Lona Scherfig's new film, Their Finest. Discussing it will be our finest, Jenna Hobbs, and me, the just fine, Jake Cunningham.
Hi, Jake.
Hi, Jen. How are you doing?
Good, thanks. I feel like, because I've not been here for a few weeks, you brought me out especially for that pun.
Yeah. I mean, I probably would have gone for that one with anyone, really.
Way to make a girl feel special.
Yeah. It's good to have you back, Jen. It's been
Thanks.
A while. Yeah. And so this week we're talking about Their Finest, which is a film set during World War II about Katrine Cole, played by Gemma Arterton, who is a screenwriter tasked with making a morale-boosting Dunkirk film. And I think, yeah, people maybe feel the need for morale-boosting, politically-aimed content at the moment. So
yeah.
It feels a bit appropriate that we should be talking about this. Not to say any reason why we'd need that, but
I don't know to what you might be referring.
Yeah, not why would anyone need their morale boosting in regard to politics?
We all live in a happy utopia here.
We certainly do. We just live inside this booth. Nothing goes wrong inside the booth.
Jake's a wonderful dictator.
you're not the guest. You're just the last one left.
Yeah.
So this film, we've got, as I said, Gemma Arterton as Katrine Cole, the screenwriter. We've also got Sam Claflin as Tom Buckley, who's one of her writing partners, and Bill Nighy as Ambrose Hilliard, who is an actor in this film. So as a bit of a treat for today, we've actually got, as well as our comprehensive review of Their Finest, we've got two interviews, and those are with Gemma Arterton and Bill Nighy, and we will be dropping them in to the show. But as always, we must start with our podcast pitch, and this podcast pitch this week is inspired by the trueness of this tale, because it very much feels like a true story, which it's not, but as you're watching it, you do think, this does feel like it happened, and in the film, it actually goes into the adaptation of truth from journalism and mm-hmm. never letting the truth get in the way of a good story, as Claflin puts it. And so for the podcast pitch, I wanted to ask you, Jen, to pitch me a story inspired by a true story and maybe weave in some less than truth in there too.
I think I've gone for some lot less than truth.
Okay.
But I've taken a long time thinking about this. And one of the things I've always wanted to see on film that I don't think's ever been done very much or particularly well, maybe, is a true depiction of life inside the Chelsea Hotel in the 60s in New York.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, of what it was like. So I was thinking about all the cool people that have lived there, and I want to see them all in the background shots. But that's not the main focus of the film. We're not just following the Chelsea Hotel. I specifically want to follow Bob Dylan mm-hmm. and Joni Mitchell. Right?
Yeah.
Because back in 2010, there was some beef between them where she did an interview and she said that Bob Dylan was a fake and that he was a plagiarizer.
He's fake news.
He's fake news. And she never really backed it up. She just said these like bombs in an interview, yeah, and no one really knows what she means. So I say we wind back from 2010 when Joni's giving this interview.
Yeah.
And then we see them living together in the Chelsea Hotel, right? And Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan are making an album together.
Right.
So they're going through the whole process and it's great and it's really collaborative and it's going really well. And then this is when Joni discovers the truth about Bob.
Which is?
Well, I haven't got that far yet.
Okay, all right.
But that maybe he's got like puppets that work for him.
Just improvise it.
Bob Dylan is the Shakespeare of 60s music.
Oh, right. And so someone else was writing all this music.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
And Joni discovers it and she's keeping that secret until 2010.
I thought you were going to go down like the... Like we recently had Neruda out, which is obviously a very loose... true story,
mm-hmm,
because it's adapted from the notes of a poet,
yeah,
and so it goes really for the poetry of the story rather than the truth of the story. And so I think in the Chelsea Hotel, all the craziness that's going on there,
mm-hmm,
you could really have some fun with that. I could see that existing. Yeah. That is in the realms of plausibility.
Yeah, and so there's a secret album out there that's, yeah, Bob and Joni's duet album.
Yeah, and there was that Sky show that came out with a guy playing Michael Jackson, and like it's all based on true fake stories or like rumors of recreations of famous meetings that, mm-hmm, we're not sure whether they happened. Maybe don't go completely down that route because I know that one wasn't extremely well received.
Cancelled, wasn't it?
Yeah, but. You could take some loose inspiration for that of trying to tell these stories that no one quite knows about.
Potentially, it all happened there. Yeah.
Okay. I like that. Yeah.
Thanks, Jake.
I've gone with the one sentence. It's pretty long, but I'll just pitch it right out to you. So, this is about a White House nuclear policy analyst,
mm-hmm,
who retires to open her own gourmet food store, and through popular demand, she starts writing books. And then gets her own cooking show. But in 2017, after North Korea sends a nuclear threat, she's forced to come out of retirement and cook up some revenge. Yes, it's the Food Network's own Ina Garten, a.k.a. the Barefoot Contessa, in Gas Mark Action. There you go.
Oh, yeah, you win, didn't you?
Oh, yes, yes. Thank you, Jen. I won't tell you which part of that is not true.
Is any of it true, Jake?
Yeah. Everything up... This is the crazy thing, all right? Everything up until the coming out of retirement to cook up revenge is true.
That's mad.
Yeah. People that don't know this, fans of the Food Network... Ina Garten was Richard Nixon's White House nuclear policy analyst.
Madness.
Yeah, it is madness. And that's true.
A portfolio career for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. Now she's just cooking, like, butter all the time. So much butter. I should have called it butter or something. Yeah. There we are. So, I think that might be the first time.
Is it the first time?
Yeah, I've always felt...
I'm too lenient on you.
Yeah, I've always felt weird when I'm hosting to give myself points.
Yeah,
so you jump right in there, and I'm going to take it, Jen. I'm going to have it.
It's all right, I'm already on 2.5, so I think winning.
You're flying ahead. All right, so there we are, back on to their finest, and we will begin by speaking to Gemma Arterton, the star of the film as Katrine Cole. So we are delighted to welcome Gemma Arterton, star of Their Finest, onto the Curzon Film Podcast this week. How are you doing today, Gemma?
I'm really well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very, very well.
Good.
So I've just watched the film yesterday, and initially when I was watching it, I thought it's got that feeling of being a true story. It felt like a story that people would know. And then, so I was surprised to find that it was a fiction. And I wanted to start by asking you how you then get into the headspace of... Katrine Cole, beyond just the script, like what were your research points?
So she's based on a real life character that Lissa Evans, who wrote the book Their Finest Hour and a Half, knew about her. because Lissa used to work in broadcasting and is also Welsh. And I think she kind of, you know, found out about Diana Morgan, who's the real Catherine Cole. And kind of that's what inspired the book. So I did a little research on Diana, who was this, she was brought on by Ealing Studios to write the nausea, or the female dialogue, and actually became one of the main writers at Ealing during that kind of golden age of filmmaking for them, but was sort of an unsung hero of Ealing Studios, and a lot of her work, we're not sure if it was hers or if some of her work was nabbed, or, you know, because women weren't really credited until really like the late 50s on films, unless they were an actor. So I sort of did a bit of work on her, and also, you know, I had the gift of the book, which, you know, is so much more elaborate, and obviously there's a lot more going on. Actually, Catherine's character is, there's more of Ambrose Hilliard in the book, and there's a few other characters, but, you know, there was a bit of detail there. But, I just sort of trusted the script, and I worked a lot with Lona, and Lona's a really generous director with her actors. I think Sam and I started working on the script and the characterization really, really early in like March, and we started shooting in September. So we were starting to work with the language, which was really specific and rhythmic, and also I had obviously the accent to deal with as well, which was actually a real key for me in terms of getting into the character, because she's got that kind of other, there's something quite sort of lyrical about her and gentle, and her voice is different to mine. And then Lona and I went to a few exhibitions, wartime exhibitions, and I did lots of research, watched a lot of the movies of that period. But actually, you know, when you're playing a character in a period film, I think you have to kind of not play the period. There are certain things, you know, like the way they sit, the way they, you know, women sort of held themselves differently or whatever, but actually we wanted to make it feel relevant to now, and I think all of us were aware of not making it feel stiff or stuffy. And making it relevant and like we wanted, you definitely see that with Bill's characterization, and I wanted mine as well to feel like a girl that you could know from anywhere, you know, anytime.
Yeah, it's remarkable how casually it's said in the film that naturally you can't get paid the same as the men, and I wonder at what points were you just startled at bits in the script thinking, why is that so casual?
Right. Well, it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a fact of life, and even until, well, now.
Yeah.
I think now people would obviously not say that, but the fact that it is set in the 40s sort of helpful for us as storytellers, because we can demonstrate the sexism and Catherine at first just accepts it, and I think feminism hadn't happened yet, so no one was really going, hang on a minute, you know, this was the first time really that women were given jobs, you know, men's jobs, because they were needed. All the men were off and fighting in the war, so all of a sudden women were, you know, being postmen and driving buses, and I think they were kind of, you know, the sexism in the film is sort of, it's very subtly displayed. I think it's really masterfully done, actually. Catherine doesn't retaliate, she just sort of takes it, and then as time goes on, it's actually the writing of the film that makes her question things and ask for more money and insist that the girls are the heroes of the film, and you know, but it's because she believes in the film so much. So yeah, I like that it doesn't feel like it doesn't bash you over the head with its feminism.
Yeah, and it was Catherine's job to write the women's dialogue, which was given the slang of slop. And I wonder, 70 odd years later,
whether you ever find yourself watching something made now or reading a script now and you still think that it's still getting the same treatment.
I don't think that. Sometimes I think, oh, we should have more women writers just because that's a different perspective. So, you know, like, I was at the Venice Film Festival last year on the jury, and there was only one film in the competition that was written by a woman. And I remember thinking, that's such a shame, because that's a whole different perspective that's not being given, you know. And maybe it's because there's not as many films made by women, or there's not as many scripts being written by women. But it's sort of, you know, it's got to... That's what I think. I don't think that there's a difference between the way a man and a woman write, but I do think that a woman's perspective is obviously different to a man's perspective, and so there might be different ways of seeing things. I remember making a film with Marjan Satrapi, who is a friend of mine, and she made this sort of movie that it was like a horror movie, but the way she decided to portray the horror was not sexual or blood and guts, or it was actually kind of like beautiful. Mm. Like when someone got stabbed, instead of there being blood everywhere, there would be like cupcakes coming out, you know.
The voices.
It was pink. Was pink. So it's a different perspective. It's like they can still tell the same stories, but they just have a different way of seeing things, different experience to talk about. So that's what I think.
I think one of my favourite sequences in this film is just after you're by the shop that gets bombed and walking past the mannequins.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a really startling sequence, because you go through so many different waves of feeling in such a short amount of time, and it then becomes a bit farcical and then comedy, and then you're grounded again at the end of the sequence. And I think that's really sums up what Their Finest is going for as well, that there is this escapism and there is this humour and friendship that people found during the war, but at home that horror still remains.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of overriding nostalgia for what was going on in London at the time. It was pretty, I mean, it was terrifying, obviously. People's lives were turned upside down. People were dying. Their homes were being destroyed. They didn't know if their loved ones were safe. And yet there was this real sense of community and people, a sense of humour, and people just getting on with it because they have to, sense of pride, and all of these things at the same time. And I think you're right, there are times in this film where all of those emotions happen within 5 minutes, and I think if we can kind of get close to any sort of feeling of what was going on, then that's probably it. I think it's a real love letter to the British spirit.
Mm. And playing this writer, did it inspire you? Do you feel like you'd be writing anything anytime?
I would love to be a good writer. I mean, I'm just not. I've been collaborating with writers. I have a friend who's a sublime writer, and she's been sort of allowing me to come in and help her on some of the scripts that she's writing, which she doesn't need. But I don't think I could sit down with a computer and just write. But watching the... some of my favourite scenes are the scenes in the writing room where they're just brainstorming. And I mean, it's so thrilling. I think that's, for me, that would be the way I could do it. I don't think I could do it on my own, you know, just sitting there. But I'd
get you a typewriter. And
I actually did get a typewriter, 1940s typewriter, in honour of this movie, as I loved learning to type. Yeah.
Excellent. Gemma Austin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So there we are, the lovely Gemma Arterton there talking about her role as Katrine Cole, a screenwriter torn between both men and work during the war. And you were saying to me before we started recording there that this is giving us a good insight into how the war created jobs for women, which wasn't really a thing.
Yeah, I think it's something that I don't necessarily think about, the fact that women kind of weren't allowed to work. You know, you were set up to have children and run a home, and that was kind of the plan. You maybe did a few things from home and sold things to make extra money if your family needed it. But in general, women didn't work. And as I was watching this film set in the war, I realised that my gran had her first ever job during the war when she was 18. And then after that, she was able to work for the rest of her life. But she was the first woman in her like generation of women to have a job. Isn't that mad?
It is, yeah. And what's a bit different about this film that I hadn't quite thought about, when we often see female workers during the war, it's often in kind of bullet factories, mm-hmm. Or sewing, or as nurses. And I don't think I'd ever really seen a female worker within the arts.
Yeah,
that was the odd thing. And I like that she's not bumbling, and she's not confused, and she's not out of her depth. She's
very in control, isn't she, of the situation. And, you know, there's a few comments of, I have to work with a woman or things like that. But she kind of takes everything in her stride and she doesn't let anything get to her. Because this could be a film about her cracking under the pressure of being in this all-male environment, but she's ready for it.
Yeah. And there are moments where I think she is almost ready to explode, but she knows that ultimately won't get her anywhere,
yeah.
And that will only live up to the expectation that the men have, mm-hmm. of having a woman in the workplace.
Yeah, she's doing it for all women, isn't she? She's got that kind of pressure of, no, we can do this, we're not over emotional, we can make it through.
So what did we make of the film?
Yeah, I really loved it. It's a side of the war I hadn't really thought about, the propaganda films, and also how important the propaganda films were for boosting morale and for the whole country and across the seas at the time. I loved kind of sipping into that real escapism.
Mm, yeah, and it does, as we said earlier, it feels like a film of a true story, which it's not, and I think that. But the film is aware of that, and it acknowledges that when it's talking about their finest, they are making a film called The Nancy Starling,
mm-hmm.
which is a film to boost morale after Dunkirk, and it's about two girls that go in their own little boat out to the sea to bring back soldiers. And it's revealed early on, this didn't actually happen.
No.
And then it sounds too good. And that's where the story comes from, in that these two girls didn't actually do that. They did steal their dad's boat, and they did go out into the water, but that was about as far as it got.
But the idea of it was enough, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's it. And I think, and this film is inspired by Diana Morgan, who was a screenwriter during the war, mm-hmm. as well. And it's lifting the best bits from it and constructing it into something that actually has more value for the audience. And so we can add in a love interest, or we can add in, mm-hmm. a redemptive uncle. And we can add in these bits because that's what the people need at that point. And it did get me thinking, like, this film, or the film that they're making, that's fake news. but it is. And it's a weird moral quandary that I have felt only had been created in the last couple of years or so. That in this film, ultimately, that's fine.
Yeah, I suppose it's the balance of, like, how much fake news is good to have just so that everyone feels happy and contented and things. So I think now with like Twitter and Trump and all of that kind of stuff, you are bombarded with so much real news and fake news all at once that you don't really know what to think.
Yeah.
Whereas the good old days when people told us what we should think.
Yeah. I think in this sense, it's using real people to create inspiration for goodness,
mm-hmm.
which is not what we have now.
No.
Like it's the opposite of that. It's using maybe the tiniest 1% of truth to extrapolate and
create fear.
Yeah.
We've gone. It's like that is such an era of hope. Even though these terrible things are happening around people, you know, with Winston Churchill's speeches and everything that people were doing, it was to create a hope amongst the people. Whereas now it feels like a fear amongst the people is what's being created.
Mm. Yeah, and. Right, so let's think about the tone of the film here, because it's when you go on, I don't know, Wikipedia or IMDb or something, it's sold as a romantic comedy, and I think that's a bit cruel on it, because I think it's got a bit more weight than that.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you.
Yeah, because at the start of the film, we're introduced to Katrine and her husband, and then we get introduced to Sam Claflin, who's, we know, is on all the posters and is very nice. And when they first meet, oh, they don't quite get along, do they? And then Claflin kind of presents, through his knowledge of screenwriting, where the plot will go, because of they need to write the plot for the Nancy Starling, and in doing so he presents this meta plot for where we think their finest will go as well. And it does really well to deviate from that as well, because it gives us this structure, it tells us where it's going to go, and we think, because of so many romantic comedies we've seen, we think we know where it's going to go. But then throughout, it just reminds us of how the war just completely tore up these narratives for people, these real life narratives.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I definitely really bought into the rom-com nature of it, like, you know, from the whole way through with her artist husband. I was like, no, he's a scoundrel, he's not good enough for you, and I could see the goodness within Sam Claflin's character, and I really wanted them to get together, and I was really like behind that story and really bought into it, for sure. Yeah. But yes, you're right, the war took away a lot of those happy stories. A lot of people's husbands never came back, and I think it would do a disservice to the time period to not kind of realise that.
And it does a disservice to the film to say that the romance is the first thing that you define it by.
Yeah, you're right. It's a powerful story about a woman making her way and doing something really great and interesting and being on a film set. It's it's a really interesting story to uncover and to pick apart.
Yeah, it would, like, it could exist. I know why the romance is there, is to sell the film. It's like, that's to hook people in. It could work without that element at all.
Definitely.
Like, she could be quite content already married, and we remove that element, and that would even be an amazing statement as well, to have this film, and that she is, as a male work partner, who is not relied on as a love interest. But that's a story for another film. But it does really work well in those moments when she's working, and I think that's when it...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So it's most invigorating when it's easy to get hooked into the clicking and clacking of typewriters and pins going up on the wall and bits of string as they're plotting out a story, but it doesn't matter, because it's still just really enticing, isn't it?
It is, yeah. What is it they called female dialogue in that film?
Slop.
Oh, that really got my goat, Jake.
Yeah. I mean, Jen, you actually are both a female and a writer.
Yeah. I am indeed. I've not yet been told I write slop, but maybe it's coming.
And I wonder how, for you, this, ultimately, the story here is key for what you're doing now.
Yeah.
And did it make you think about that at all?
Yeah, definitely at points. I think, like I kind of said to you before, that it's always amazing to remind yourself that women had to go out there and be the first one to do it. And aren't I in a lucky position where, although it's a bit crazy to go, I'm going to be a writer, because that's really unstable, it's not as crazy as it would have been 50 years ago or more. And yeah, I could definitely kind of see myself there, the romantic view of, like, at the typewriter, this is my lovely life. Mm. yeah, definitely.
I think I could see you doing it as well, actually. Yeah. Particularly the bit where they go on a nice holiday.
I'm good at a holiday, Jake.
So the film begins with the writing all happening in London, and then once they've got their film, the Nancy Starling, and they've got their crew, they head off to shoot, obviously not in Dunkirk. Is it Dorset?
It's in Devon.
Devon. Mm. Your rival.
I know, I'm Cornish.
Yeah. How did you feel about that? You know.
Well, I do have to admit that Devon is pretty, I suppose.
It made a good Dunkirk. I think it did. I believe it. And then we spend quite a bit of the film in a little pub and on the beach and just around this little village where it's being made.
The funny thing is that Devon and Cornwall, you know, they're not a million miles apart. And although that was, you know, way back in time, that does not feel very different at all to the Devon and Cornwall I know.
Yeah. And those bits, when you get away from the city, you can see the comfort in the relationship start developing as well. And I think that's really strong, particularly, who we haven't talked about that, with Ambrose Hilliard, Bill Nye's character. He really comes into his own at that point.
He is such a gem of this film.
Yeah.
Any screen time he has is just incredible.
Yeah. So let's have a quick chat about him. So he's, I imagine he was once a big name, and he's not quite a big name there now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a form of comeback role. And not so dissimilar to the kind of role that we see any number of older English actors doing now after they've been away from the spotlight for a bit and then come back. He's almost Michael Keatoning.
Yeah.
Is what he's doing. And Bill Nye really tackles this well. And, I mean, it's Bill Nye doing Bill Nye, but it's built around him perfectly, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And also, how lucky Bill Nye's never really had to do that comeback. He's just had a straight through.
Yeah. So let's hear from the man himself. I sat down with Bill Nye to talk about the role of Ambrose Hilliard.
But I don't know why I gave up watching films on planes, but I just did. It's something about it. I get a ridiculous amount of satisfaction not opening the headphone bag. I know you're looking at me as if I'm a weirdo, and you're quite right. But I just don't watch them anymore. I just read, sleep.
And I suppose
sleep,
in
read.
That time you can start the book and finish it.
Oh, I got through three books. If you go to Australia and New Zealand, you know, it's like, you know, you've got all the time in the world.
Brilliant. We are thrilled to welcome Bill Nye onto the Curzon Film Podcast to talk about their finest this week.
My pleasure.
So, Bill, your character, Ambrose Hilliard, I mean, when you first meet him at the start of the film, he's like the impression that people like to do of a serious actor in the pub, isn't he?
Yeah, he fulfills almost completely the cliche idea about actors. There are three things that people say about my job in the same way as there are probably three things they say about your job. The three things they might say about my job is that we're all extroverts, we would crawl over each other's dead bodies to get to a part, and that we're sexually incontinent. None of which is true, of course, apart from the sexually incontinent bit, which is obviously true.
Obviously, yeah. And where is this Hilliard? For me, it got a sense of the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes in it. Well, what performances were you grounding it on?
Well, none, really. I didn't look at anyone at all. I simply went by what was suggested by the script. And the script was such a cracker. You know, they're rare scripts of good scripts, and this was such a, you know, a great one that great writing just persuades you into certain performances or certain behavior, you know. I've got to that age where I can answer certain questions perfectly honestly. One of which is asked often, which is, how much research did you do for this part? And if you ask me that, I can honestly say I did absolutely no research whatsoever. And I get a big bang out of saying that, because you're not supposed to.
Excellent. Well, I must say, your no research, it really showed.
Oh, well,
an excellent
you.
Way.
Thank you.
And
how dare you? No. Thank you.
And Hilliard's opinion of the role he's playing, that shifts. Initially, he thinks of the character of Uncle Frank as a drunk fool, and then he gets a bit more out of it and a bit more out of it. And I wonder, was there ever a role of yours that initially you were given at the start and thought, oh, it's nothing really, but then you
got into it a bit more as you learnt a bit more about it?
Well, I tend to, over the years, I used to, I don't know if I still do it so much, I don't think I do it now, but I used to sort of live in a, and I'm not even kidding, I used to live in a sort of hostile parallel universe in which I was about to be humiliated. It was what I had in lieu of a method or a process of any kind. And I would often finish a job and think that I'd humiliated myself, and then people would be quite positive about it, and it would always come as a kind of surprise to me. I don't know if that answers your question specifically, but I mean, the thing is, as soon as he doesn't want to, Ambrose is in almost perfect denial about how old he is, and when he's given the script, he still thinks at his time of life he's eligible to play the young romantic lead, which is, you know, pathetic. And then when it's explained to him that he's being offered drunken Uncle Frank, he's initially appalled. But as soon as he starts to play it, because he's got no alternative, because there's no other gig and he's got no money, and people start saying nice things, suddenly, you know, everything's okay.
Yeah. And I wonder, have you ever been given a script for a drunken Uncle Frank, turned it down, and then actually seen what that role could have been?
I don't think so, no. I don't think I've ever... I don't think I've been asked, you know, do I regret turning anything down? I don't... There's nothing really that I regret turning anything down, no. As far as I know, there might be one that I'm unaware of that's, you know, that exploded elsewhere and was a fabulous success. But I don't... Not that I remember, no.
And there's a really lovely a scene in this where you sing Wild Mountain Time in the village pub, and it reminded me of a similar moment in Pride as well, in the village hall.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could tell me what the sets are like in those communal moments.
Well, that was that in the script, I think it simply said they gather around the piano or something. And Lona Scherfig, the fabulous filmmaker who made this film, obviously extended it into what's really one of the, you know, sort of central scenes in the movie now. And it's great just to see people turn off all their politics and their concerns about the war and just sing, you know, and listen while people sing a couple of songs. It's kind of very moving. And it was a very nice feeling on the set. It was, I mean, apart from me, obviously, because I get the wind up, you know. I can sing, you know, I can hold a tune, as they say, but it's not something I do easily. But once I'd done it a couple of times and people were kind, you know, you get into it. And the girls sang beautifully. I love that song, you know, it's a beautiful song and such a perfect wartime song. But it's nice to see, and it is exactly what happens, you know, not just with actors, but with anybody who works away from home, where they gather in pubs or hotels, you know, people, you know, stand around and have a sing-song or just hang out and, you know, and have some fun.
Yeah, it's a really lovely moment in the film that gives it a bit of breath, because we'd just come out of the war-torn London at that time as well. And it's... then a similar moment in Pride, it just gives it, lifts a bit of the weight from the film.
Yeah, I loved that hall, all the scenes in the hall in Pride. I was desperate to be in Pride, and I was very, very, if you'll excuse the pun, proud of what Matthew Walchess and Stephen Beresford achieved, the director and the writer.
And talking of singing, when I came in the room here, you were listening to some James Brown.
Yeah.
And so if we were to get you up on the piano, is that what you'd be singing?
I don't know if I'd attempt a James Brown song. It's very hard to sing anything that James Brown sung, because why would you? Because James did it, you know. But the song that's been I've been obsessing over today is Out of Sight by James Brown. Check it out.
Excellent. So you mentioned there that Ambrose Hilliard is a bit too old for the things that he's doing in terms of his character. And this year you revisited the role of Billy Mack as well Red Nose Day, actually. And this year also marks 10 years since you were Davy Jones too.
Oh, right.
There's a new Pirates film this year.
Oh,
how,
really?
I wonder how do you look back on those films?
With great affection and gratitude, and wonderful memories, wonderful people, fabulous experiences. You know, really, really kind of important times, you know. Love Actually was something that altered my professional life profoundly, Pirates of the Caribbean was one of the opportunities that derived from that. Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, those movies are beloved, as is Love Actually. You know, they entered the language, those films, you know, in a way that not many films do. And to have been involved in one of them is something. To have been involved in several is a very, you know, I'm a lucky, beyond fortunate man.
Yeah, but I think they're pretty physically demanding with the amount of CG and physical work that's going into them. Would you ever fancy getting the tentacles back on?
Yeah, no, I'd love it. And actually, the process has moved on, because they never stop. It always moves on. But even then, it was I was, you know, at the beginning when they paint 250, I can't remember, I used to have black dots and white dots all over my face and put you in very sad computer pajamas with white bubbles all over. It's a very lonely place to find yourself. But luckily, they ran out of jokes in about the second week. But it means that you don't have to wear all that stuff, because there are 100 geniuses on computers that later are going to faithfully report your, you know, transfer your performance into the creature. So, yeah, I'd be very happy to ride again. Excellent. To sail again. Yeah.
Brilliant. Bill Nye, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Cheers.
So there we are, Bill Nye there. Now you're saying that Bill Nye never really had to do the go out and come back, because he actually came into thing quite late, because in the interview there he says that it was Love Actually that really broke him.
Really?
Yeah, and like that's what gave him Davy Jones in Pirates of the Caribbean. So it's only in the last 10-15 years that he's been a big name.
Isn't
I think
that
of
mad?
Him
yeah I think of him as like this institution.
Yeah. I like, he was popular, but that's not really, like, that's only come now. Which actually reminds me of, I was listening to Soundtracking, Edith mm-hmm. Bowman's show with Edgar Wright, and he was saying that he saw the Queen musical, and in the Queen musical, they don't even have Don't Stop Me Now. And Don't Stop Me Now wasn't that big at the time, and the band were really divided on it, and then he put Don't Stop Me Now in Shaun of the Dead, and it came huge. And I just assumed, have always assumed, that Don't Stop Me Now was huge and
yeah.
one of Queen's biggest songs. And it wasn't.
That's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I literally think of it as like the first song I think of when I think of Queen.
Yeah.
That and Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah. And yeah, and Edgar Wright was like, I don't want to say that I made it.
But I did.
So there we are. That and Love Actually is the same for Bill Nye.
Madness.
Yeah. Obviously, he was doing stuff before.
Yeah, yeah. But...
just a young up-and-comer.
I suppose so. He has had these kind of perfect Bill Nye roles since then.
Mm.
Like this role, like his role in About Time, which I love that film.
Yeah.
Set
that's
in Cornwall
okay.
as well,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's very nice. And he... that film was what got me into Nick Cave as well.
Oh.
Because yeah. That's the song that he requests, Into My Arms.
Oh.
Which is, that's a horrible scene, but lovely. Anyway, so, Ambrose Hilliard. He is, I think for a lot of people, he'll be the selling point of this film.
Yes.
Because he is, it's Nye doing Nye to the nth degree. He's really going for it, because he gets to be both himself and a caricature of himself too. He's mm-hmm. really having fun with it.
And you can tell. Every time he comes on screen, I just want to laugh. Like the restaurant scene that he has where his, like, is it his manager?
Yeah, his agent.
His agent.
Oh, it's Eddie Marzan.
Yeah.
He's very good.
Really funny. And brings that, like, dead sheep's head in.
Yeah.
It's just like, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah. And you could see him having a spin-off film in himself, like just bumbling around, walking onto sets, not quite knowing what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely.
He doesn't quite get that his time is maybe over.
Mm-hmm.
When he first gets sent the script for the Nancy Starling, he thinks he is the handsome young man, not the alcoholic old uncle. And that's his journey, really, is he's having to accept that what his role within the film industry and acting, how that can differ. And part of that is down to Jake Lacey's character, Carl Lundbeck.
He was great. I love him. I love him in lots of different things. And I was really surprised to see him in this film. I just wasn't expecting it at all, but he was great. His bad acting was bad.
Yeah, this is, you might know him as Fran from Girls as well. And he, there's a different kind of bad acting between Nai and Lunbeck, because Nai's fun bad.
Well, he's bad in a like a traditional actor bad, isn't he?
Yeah, and Lacey is actually, it's a real achievement to get good bad acting without it being annoying.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And that's where the identity of Hilliard changes, because he sees this young, he's a soldier, he's not an actor, but he's good for the Allies as well. Like, 'cause he's American, they'll put him in the film and that'll boost morale across the ocean as well. And Hilliard is roped in to teach him. And that's actually a really great scene by Arterton when she convinces him to become his teacher.
Yeah.
And she just completely owns it. And she, like, at that moment, she establishes herself as having more masculinity than anyone else in the film. And, yeah, and then we get this guy learning to act. And then we're in the film. And that's once the actual... the cameras start rolling... being within the creation of the Nancy Starling is just really lovely.
So interesting. Things I never thought about how you make a how you would have made a film back then. Because now we think like, oh yeah, to create all those boats we'd use CGI or whatever. But they had like painted cloths. And I remember, because you start with that shot looking through it, and I was like, how have they done this? How have they got all the boats? And then you see Bill Nighy's character walking in it, and you realise how they've done it. Very clever. Very inventive.
Yeah, there's a great bit when they have to reconstruct the men coming onto the beach, Dunkirk, and there's this glass pane in front of the camera, and the glass pane has had the men painted onto it, so it looks like there's thousands of men. And then Nai again just ruins the frame by, by walking in front of it. Yeah, I just, I think it's always fun to see filmmaking being made.
Like, it's like the magic of it, isn't it? It's how you go and see a film and you just assume it was really easy, but actually when you actually see how it was done, you're even more amazed by it. Like when you go to the Harry Potter studio tour or whatever and you see the mini Hogwarts that they use for all the panning shots, it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, and I imagine on set it must have been a complete nightmare having your crew and then your second crew and then your actors. And yeah, it's those are really great, those bits. And we should probably get into some spoilery stuff in a bit. But before we go on to that, was there anything else you wanted to bring up?
I loved in London how they didn't shy away from kind of the devastation of the bombing. At points, you know, when the bombing has occurred and you see Gemma Arterton's character, Katrin, looking around the rubble and things, and you see, like, amongst mannequins, like, a dead woman, and it doesn't shy away from how gritty and horrible that experience was for people, as well as it being a light, fun film to enjoy. You get a bit of both, which I think's really nice.
Yeah, it is constantly grounding you, which is important, because it is quite easy to get caught up in the romanticizing
romanticizing
of the war, and it does well to bring us back from that. Right, so if you haven't watched it, what are you doing? Go and watch Their Finest in cinemas from today, and once you've done that, come back, hear our spoiler section, and any recommendations that we've got on the Curzon Home Cinema Service. That's your spoiler warning now. So, not everyone made it out alive.
Really wasn't expecting that, Jake.
Yeah.
I'd really bought into the romance of it all.
Mm.
And it was a bit heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. And as soon as someone says that they'll come back later, you just know they've signed their death note.
Don't do it.
Just don't leave. And why would you anyway? You're writers. You're done. You've said, what are you doing on set? Just leave. No one's going to notice.
No one will know.
Yeah, it's fine. So Sam Claflin didn't make it. And
the second time he's done that to me in a film in recent times.
What was the other time?
Me Before You.
Oh, yeah. And Hunger Games.
Yes, and Hunger Games.
Mate, this guy, he's carving out a niche. Sam Claflin will never make it till the end of the film. Not on my watch. But I ultimately quite like it, because we mentioned in the main section that they set us out this structure of a romantic comedy and how the dynamic between her and her husband and him is going to play out. And ultimately, it is not what we're told it's going to be.
I did know her husband was a scoundrel, though.
Yeah?
No man who's an artist during the war is a good man.
Is he not?
That's what I've decided.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that sounded like an old saying that like your grandmother told you or something.
My grandmother always said.
Let me tell you, no man who was an artist during the war is not a scoundrel.
Some words I live my life by. Yeah. But I was not surprised when she came back and he was having an affair.
No. He was unpleasant, wasn't he?
He was.
Yeah.
And then she put her wedding ring in the bin.
Yeah, she could have sold that.
People are starving.
Oh, no, I think it was not expensive. She bought it at Woolworths.
Woolworths, of course.
Oh, man. Remember Woolworths?
Oh, what those a time. Were the days.
That was the best bit of this film.
Like, thinking, the memories.
Yeah, the way that it made me think about Woolworths and how it existed. What a time. Gosh.
Are we now living more of our lives without Woolworths than with Woolworths?
No.
Not yet.
Not yet, no.
That'll come, though, Jake.
I never want to see that day come. I will Sam Claflin myself before I have to live in a time where Woolworths was away for most of my life. Yeah. Come the end of the film, we've kind of got Hilliard has become a teacher for Jake Lacy, and I think that's more his role. That mm-hmm. He's seeing himself as becoming this acting teacher, which if you're going to have an acting teacher, sounds like a pretty good one.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Thankfully... Carl Lundbeck won't be acting anymore. Just the one role and out, that's fine. But this was a thing, even in Powell and Pressburger's Canterbury Tale.
I was just thinking about that, yes.
Yeah, the lead actor was a genuine American soldier.
Yeah, and he just did the one film and never to be acting again.
Yeah.
But that was the thing about the wartime, wasn't it? That people just did loads of different things because half the men were away or doing this or doing that, and there weren't really as many rules as there'd been before.
And I think even in the construction of the film itself is more treated as a job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we like to think of film as art, mm-hmm. and it's vocational and it must be done for the person. Whereas it is ultimately not for anyone that's making it.
Yeah, it's for the public.
Yeah, and so it is a public service, mm-hmm. and everyone is there to do a job. So if the man from the army gets told this is going to be your job, he's an army man, so he's got to obey orders. And I think that's almost how the film is being treated as they're making it as mm-hmm. well. It's the thing that needs to be done. And I quite liked that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, so there we are. That is Their Finest, and that's in cinemas now, so do go and check it out. We've also got The Happiest Day in the Life of Ollie Mackey going on Curzon Home Cinema from today. That's Juho Kuzmanen's film. It won the prize in a certain regard at Cannes. It's a Finnish black and white film about a boxer. And what would you like to recommend, Jen?
So, I'd really like to recommend Curzon Home Cinema's new collection called New British Talent, which has got some absolutely great films on it. It's got Notes on Blindness, which was actually my favourite film of last year, on there. It's got The Falling on it, which I had completely forgotten that I'd watched a couple of years ago and absolutely loved. And I'm going to rewatch it this week because it's just great. You won't regret watching that one. And 45 Years, the Oscar-nominated Charlotte Rampling stars in that film, and it's truly beautiful. And there's so many other films in that collection that are really worth a watch.
Yeah, I think you've got one of my favourite films from the last few years, Slow West, 20,000 Days on Earth, which is a documentary about Nick Cave, Orion, The Man Who Would Be King, another doc about a guy who impersonated Elvis but wore a mask and people thought he actually was Elvis, and that's excellent, and not enough people saw that. It was on Arena on BBC4 a few years ago, but do check that out. That's very cool. That's actually a really great collection, so do check that one out, the New British Talent one. Right, but that's all we've got time for. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to CSR for letting us use their studio. And thank you to our writer in residence, Jenna Hobbs. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jake. See you soon.
And we will see you soon. Join us next week. Bye-bye.
it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently, so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.